Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For months now, the government of Syria has been facing a very serious challenge to its authority, really the most serious challenge to its authority in something like four decades. Protests in Syria began in March on the 18th, inspired by, in part at least, by the success of anti-government protests that had gone on earlier in Tunisia and Egypt. The government responded with force, and by some estimates now, as many as 5,000 people have been killed, and between 15,000 and 40,000 people arrested. We will be talking this morning about what's going on here in Syria, what has been going on, and some recent developments here as the government of Syria has agreed to a proposal by the Arab League to admit monitors to the country. Our guest for the program in this hour is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies and associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment. That's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics that is widely read. He's done a lot of speaking, has talked regularly with officials in Washington and consulted with the State Department, other government agencies. He's been good enough to spend some time with us this morning here on the telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, your questions are certainly welcome. And Professor Landis, hello.
How are you?
I'm
good
fine.
To be with you again.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us once again. We certainly appreciate your time. Well, I want to make sure that fairly quickly here in the conversation we talk about this recent development with the Syrian government agreeing to the proposal of the Arab League. But before that, let me just ask you a more general kind of question. I think when we last talked, and I believe that was in May, at that point, I think your general assessment of what was going on there was Syria was that on the one hand, that the protesters did not have the strength to topple the government, and on the other, that the government really didn't, although it had responded in force, really didn't have the strength to stop the protest. So there was something of a stalemate. That was then. So is that still the situation today?
I fear it is. Obviously, the situation looks grimmer for the regime today. Things are going badly out of control. The economy is spiraling downwards. The international community is getting organized. The opposition, which was not very militarized at the time we spoke last, has become increasingly militarized. The Free Syrian Army has emerged, but there are lots of groups within Syria. We're not sure how related they are to the Free Syrian Army. Are carrying out operations, and the death rate is going up. Yesterday, Al Jazeera said 100 people were killed. Possibly 72 of those were soldiers who the opposition said were killed by fellow soldiers for deserting. But this seems to me unlikely. They were probably, there could have been a firefight or an ambush by the opposition. This has been going on. And so things are getting worse. On the other hand, I can't see yet how the opposition is going to take down this regime. The Syrian army has not divided in an important way. There have been defections in the lower ranks, some important ones. But the core of the officer corps stayed together. They have tanks. They have helicopters. They can do a lot of damage, and they're not about to lay down their arms because for most of these commanders, the alternative is going to be probably a trial, perhaps, but they'll be hung for what they've done. So there is, right now, it's very hard to see a way out of this and see how either side is going to give up.
Hmm. Well, now, the most recent development here, and this just happened yesterday, the government of Syria agreed, with apparently some modifications, to a proposal that had been on the table now, had been made by the Arab League back in late last month, that would allow outside observers into the country, which is something that up to this point, the Syrian government has steadfastly said, no,
right,
we will not do that. And we can talk about perhaps why it is that the government felt compelled to do this. But maybe the before that, you can explain just a little bit what is this proposal? What was it that the Arab League was calling for?
Well, let me first start out with the greater strategy of the international community and how they hope to corner Syria and get the government to resign. The problem for the international community is that they're willing to ratchet up the rhetorical condemnation of Syria and to paint the picture of this dire conflict, but and ask for Assad to go. But nobody wants to intervene militarily. They don't want to do what they did with Saddam Hussein, certainly, and send in the American army. Nobody's going to do that. But even in a Libya situation where you have close ground air support for an opposition going in, it seems to be beyond at least the thinking at NATO has said they're not going to do that, and the Defense Department in the U.S. has said they're not going to do that. So this leaves the international community in a bind. On the other hand, what they need to get is a condemnation of Syria in the Security Council. That's what they had for Iraq. That's what they had for Libya. It allowed them under Chapter 7 that if Syria does not stop killing civilians and following humanitarian guidelines, then military force can be used by somebody. Now, that's what they want to have on the table, passed by the UN, in order to ratchet up pressure on their Syrian regime. Russia, China, and the BRIC countries have refused to go along with this because they did not like what happened in Libya. They gave a condemnation statement in order to protect civilians, not to go hunting Gaddafi and destroying his military, which is what the mission turned into very quickly. And they fear that that's what's going to happen in Syria. They don't want to see it, and they're resisting. So far, we're blocked. Now, how do you get Russia and China to go along with you? This is where the Arab League comes in. And the West has been putting a lot of pressure on the Arab League to say, to condemn Assad and to take strong movements that would then embarrass the Russians and, in a sense, corner the Russians to change their line. And that seems to be happening to a certain extent because the Russians are really, I think, in large part responsible for the Syrians accepting this Arab League measure. The Arab League had said that they were going to report Syria and take their case to the National Security Council to get this condemnation. The Russians called the Syrians and said, look, you've got to accept this. Having these observers in there, which would delay any Arab League action for 2 months. And you've got to play this game. And the Syrians need time, and they think they're still going to win this. So they're going along. And undoubtedly, they think that they're playing for time. There are two conflicting narratives going on. The Syrian government says we are acting, as any government would, to suppress a violent revolutionary force that's led by outside forces. And our use of force is not been indiscriminate, and it's been, this is what we have to do to bring stability to our country. The opposition is saying, look, this is ridiculous. This is a dictatorship run by a minority. They've been doing this for 40 years, and now they're killing unarmed opposition. And those are the two narratives. The Arab League is putting themselves in the middle of this by sending observers, 100 in a few days, and up to 500 theoretically later on, who are going to go out and monitor the situation. The Syrians have promised to withdraw their military from urban centers. The opposition, it's also incumbent on the opposition to stop any kind of violent protest. But they can still protest, I guess, openly, although in Syrian law you have to have a permit to protest in the same way you do in the United States. You can't just, that's why this 99% movement has been chased out of squares and so forth. So it's unclear, really, what these observers are going to be able to do, because they're adjudicating in the middle of a revolution. And, what is the appropriate amount of force that a state can use against demonstrators and against an opposition that wants to overthrow the regime? Very unclear question.
What this is, at least in terms of how international relations work and how what countries do, it's fascinating in the sense that we had the situation where it seemed that the Arab League was becoming increasingly impatient in an effort to try to put some pressure on the Syrians. They said, look, the point's coming when we're going to go, this has got to go to the General Assembly and then perhaps to the Security Council. And then the Russians seemed to be saying, look, there's a certain point where we can't really do anything to help you, Syria. Maybe you could just go along to get along for a little while here. And so we come to the point where the Syrians reluctantly agree to do this. All that's fascinating, but at the same time, the opposition in Syria seems to be saying, well, this really doesn't mean anything, that what the government is indeed doing here is just buying time. This is not a particularly important concession. It won't do anything for us. So perhaps the question is just how important is this? Will this, in fact, accomplish anything, or might it simply tamp down the violence for a little while?
Well, we'll have to see. Obviously, everybody's going to be on their best behavior. These observers are going to be reporting out of Syria and talking to journalists, undoubtedly. So we're going to get a much better description of what's going on, and that's going to, you know, frighten everybody and make them be on their best behavior, we would assume. On the other hand, every time these observers go into a city like Homs or something, which has been the epicenter of this, everybody's going to demonstrate. The pro-Bashar people are going to come out and try to show that they, you know, the government's going to try to stimulate pro-government protesters. And the opposition is going to get out there and try to show that this is overwhelming support for the opposition. So in a sense, these observers, rather than tamping down violence and protest and revolution, could in fact become a catalyst for drawing the lens of the international press and scrutiny onto Syria. So it's unclear how this is going to unfold. It does buy time for Syria in theory. On the other hand, the opposition needs time too. They just had a big several-day meeting in Tunis and came out this morning with their final statement, which was a bit anodyne. And they're asking for the international community to establish, to protect Syrian citizens. And this is, it's redolent of the language that went in to the Libyan thing. They want the international community to protect citizens, not to attack, but to protect. Now, of course, there's a fine line between those two things, because once you, so they want no-fly zones and in Syria. That would mean, you know, foreign jets flying over and destroying, I guess, any Syrian military unit that goes into this no-fly. It's the beginning of close ground support for taking down the Assad regime. That's my reading of it. And that's what happened in Libya. The original thing was a condemnation protecting civilians. But of course, within a week, it was hunting Gaddafi and destroying his military forces. Because ultimately, that was what they considered the best way to protect civilians. And the international community switched the legitimate government of Libya from Gaddafi to the opposition, and then helped them win. So that's the trajectory that the opposition wants. But they're still divided, and the international community is very far from wanting to do this. And the Russians and Chinese have not signed on to an international condemnation of Syria that would allow for this kind of military intervention down the road.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at University of Oklahoma, where he is associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies. He also writes Syria Comment. That's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics, and spends a lot of time following events in Syria. We're talking about what has been going on there recently, and questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I was taking a look at Syria Comment, and one of the things that you wrote about was this recent television interview. I think it was just about 2 weeks ago that President Assad had done with Barbara Walters, where he said, essentially he said the kind of things that he's been saying for some time, that he said, well, really what he's doing is he's dealing with a terrorist threat that comes from outside of Syria. He said he was not killing his own people. He said, in fact, he thought more Syrian soldiers had been killed than civilians. He certainly showed no sign of backing down. And one of the things that he said that seemed to be pretty striking was he seemed to be saying something like, well, I'm not in control of the military.
Right.
So one wonders, well, if you're not in control of the military, who is? How did you, when you saw that interview and heard the things that he was saying, I wonder what your reaction was.
Well, you know, clearly, Bashar al-Assad was obfuscating here, and he's trying to talk to a Western audience and show that he's not a demon. That was his main objective, because the ground swell for condemnation in the UN is growing, and he's trying to head that off. But he's also telling another message, which is I'm in control. I'm doing the right thing for my country. I'm trying to restore stability, and I'm not going anywhere. And that's what he was saying. You know, I'm not to blame for this. And this is, you know, they've been trying to get me for years, and they're still trying to get me. And these are Islamic fundamentalists and terrorists and Al-Qaeda, and you went into Iraq to kill these people, and I'm killing them here. And that's, you know, that's his narrative. And, of course, it seems, you know, it's very different from the reality on the ground, because there are lots of Syrians, middle-of-the-road Syrians, who've had enough. You know, for 40 years they've lived under this. And the regime is a minoritarian-dominated regime. It's dominated by the Alawites, who are about 12% of Syria. Yes, the minority support it. Not all, but many. Christians, Druze, Ismailis, that's perhaps 25%. But the minorities cannot sit on top of the majority of Syrians forever. Now, this situation was, in a sense, created by the French colonial rule that lived in, that ruled over Syria for 25 years in the interwar period. And they privileged the minority soldiers in this little army they developed for Syria because they were the ones who were willing to work with the French the hardest and to put down the Arab nationalists. And once the French left, the military took over, and these minorities who had been overrepresented came to the top. And the Alawites won out ultimately in this struggle. And they've been ruling since 1966. So it's over four decades of Alawite-dominated rule through the Ba'ath Party. And the country's fed up. And once this Arab Spring started in Tunisia, as you said in the opener, the people latched onto it. And the young people in particular, rural elements, Syria is hammered with poverty, unemployment, overpopulation, lack of water. There's just lots of bad things. This is a perfect storm of bad news for Syria. The government just today or yesterday issued new poverty reports saying that poverty was, unemployment was close to 30% in Syria, which we sort of knew, but the official statistics that the IMF and everybody else used were like 10%, 9%, 10%, which was we all knew was crazy. But poverty levels are way up at 32. You know, the UN says 32%. It could be higher than that. And poverty is defined as $2 a day or less. Now, the international community has put on economic sanctions that are very tough on Syria. The Syrian economy, since the beginning of this revolution, in dollar terms, has fallen by one-third. The GDP has fallen by one-third. There is no fuel oil available except for extremely high prices. People are not being able to heat their apartments. They're freezing. Electricity, everybody has went out and bought these little electric heaters, but electricity is being turned off for over 6 hours a day, and that's in the evening, you know, at nighttime when the big surge comes on after dinner, and people are, you know, kids are studying by candlelight. There's no electricity. There's no heating or fuel. Even cooking gas for the stoves is hard to find. And so Syrians are headed into an extraordinarily difficult time. And if this stalemate goes on for a long time, as it could do, there will be starvation. And we know that from the Iraq example, the 1990s, with stiff sanctions, the UN estimated that over a third of a million Iraqis died due to the sanctions. And this something similar could happen in Syria unless there is a resolution to this terrible struggle that's going on.
Well, we talked, and as you talked about this when the last time we talked, and as you say here, we talked about the fact that the protests began in the southern part of the country, which is an agricultural region and where their poverty levels are pretty high. There were other significant protests in Homs, which is the third largest city. But at that time, at least, there really wasn't much going on in terms of protest in the biggest cities, Damascus, Aleppo. And your point was, well, that's where the middle and upper classes live. And generally speaking, they've done okay so far. And that let the government say, well, you know, these protesters, they're small, they're scattered. This certainly does not represent the bulk of the people of Syria.
Yeah.
Well, now for those people who were the ones who would have been able to say, you know, they've done okay, how are people, the people how who are, how, you know, how is that playing now? How are people in the middle and upper classes feeling now?
Well, they're very alienated. The pro-Bashar demonstrations we've seen in the last week or so have been much smaller than they were months ago. Clearly, the situation is deteriorating and people are scared. They can't see how the president is going to dig the country out of this abyss. On the other hand, they're very frightened of civil war, and they don't know whether the opposition has the wherewithal to replace this government. And there is no army. They don't have an army. Who are they going to use to bring order to this land? If the army is wedded to Bashar al-Assad and is dominated by Alawites, they may fight to the end. And this is the frightening situation. And we see, you know, here as we speak, the Iraqi government, with American forces just having left 2 days ago, is now looks like it's about to fall apart. The vice president, Sunni vice president, being accused of terrorism, and the other Sunnis are leaving the government. And here we have Shiites. The thing is falling apart. And that's what frightens Syrians. So even though I think many Syrians in the cities today, as they see their heating oil disappear, the economy crash, they're having to lay off employees like mad, their businesses are threatened with bankruptcy, they want a solution. They're ready for a change, but they cannot. They're stuck. And they're stuck in many ways, because what are they going to do? They're going to abandon the regime and join the revolution? Their business will be shut down. All their employees will be thrown out. They can't do that. They have a responsibility to feed people and to try to, at any rate, but they're being targeted by both sides. We've seen in Aleppo, big northern industrial city. One Olabi, one of the largest industrialists, two of his factories were burnt to the ground recently. He died, theoretically, of a heart attack after witnessing this. But other top Sunnis, capitalists in the cities, have been shot. A few have been shot. The son of the Grand Mufti was shot. The opposition is clearly targeting these people who they consider to be collaborators, regime suck-ups, making their money off the people. And they're trying to send the message, don't do it. You are risking your lives and your livelihoods if you continue to work with the government. On the other hand, the government, for its part, is targeting them as well and has put out a list of 40 industrialists who may be washing money, they say, and doing illegal things. So they've let out a little volley across the decks of the upper classes to say, don't think about it. We can take you down and shut your businesses, throw you into jail. So this upper class is very fearful. They're being targeted from both sides. They're being asked to, you know, show their flag. And there isn't a clear alternative for them. And there is an element that's beginning to fright them of a class warfare, that this is a rural revolution that's really taken fire in the countryside, where people don't have jobs, they don't have money, they're jealous of the rich, they think that all rich people have been working hand in glove with the government and are bad people. And so that's frightening. I talked to a bunch of friends in Aleppo recently, and they said where they're all thinking of getting bodyguards to put downstairs, because if the situation deteriorates, you know, people are going to come into their homes and rob them, or their cars will be stolen, and, you know, that law and order is going to break down. They're seeing the top people in the community being, you know, having their factories burnt and their. So this is the, that's the fear, and it makes it very difficult to know who to join and how to show what you want.
Let's take a caller. We have somebody in listening in, calling in from Peoria. We'll go there to our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas and all that. Middle East is going to be in turmoil. It always has been, and it probably always will be. So, I mean, I don't think that, to me, from what I see in the media and what I read on it, and from people I know that has come back that work for private contractors over there, it's very a difficult place to try and, say, organize and try and get some, you know, halfway decent going there. There's too many tribes. There's too many other outside influences from other countries there. And I think it'll always be that way. So, you know, honestly, I think we feed the lion over there. I think by us buying things from them, like the oil and other things, giving them money kind of helps feed their thirst for hatred. I think I'm a firm believer. If we leave them alone and not deal with them at all, maybe, maybe when they're not getting paid this stuff, maybe they'll straighten up. But I don't see that. And to me, it's frustrating as an American that we send our troops over there all the time, and we get killed, and we have to pay the price for their, idiotness. But I wonder what your take is on that, and I'll get off. Thanks. Merry Christmas.
Well, I think thanks for the question. I think you know, put your thumb on something that a lot of people in America feel, which is that we have way overextended ourselves in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, spent too much money and too much blood. And I don't think there is a big appetite to intervene in a place like Syria. On the other hand, there is growing outcry and pressure from think tanks and interest groups in Washington who are beginning to say, we've got to do something, this is a big chance, we can isolate Iran, Syria is an ally of Iran, an ally of Hezbollah, these are our enemies, we want to punish them and take this government down. This is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to switch the basic strategic alliance structure in the Middle East and to get Syria on the side of Saudi Arabia, put a Sunni government in there that'll be anti-Shiite, pro-American, pro-Turkey, and possibly make peace with Israel, and that way it'll be anti-Iran and anti-Hezbollah, and we can score a big one. So, yes, we won't be able to bomb and do something directly, but maybe we will, give arms, train, support the opposition in this way. And people are looking in Washington, the think tanks. You've seen a number of reports and policy proposals recently sort of coming up with these alternative strategies, how to do something that would sort of go under the radar of the American public that doesn't want to spend more money. Now, do I think that's the right thing to do? I think it'll just create a mess, frankly, in the Middle East. You can look at this in two ways, it seems to me. One is this is a Middle Eastern problem that has to be sorted out. And those people who argue that America is going to save lives by intervening, there's no proof of that. We intervened in Iraq. We intervened in Afghanistan. A lot of lives were lost. Did we save lives of what would have happened if we hadn't gone in there? I'm not sure we would have. Very hard to make that argument. You can also argue that the Syrian opposition, which is quite scattered and divided today, needs time. It needs to find unity. And the only way it's going to find unity is on the battlefield. That's the way people like George Washington emerged. People, for example, Ben-Gurion in Israel or Ataturk in Turkey, they emerged over years of fighting it out on the battlefield, and they became the center of a military and national uprising. And without that, you're not going to get unity. We saw in Iraq parachuting in there and trying to save the Iraqi people and build a nation for them. We can't do it. They've got the same divisions they've had. They have to sort out those divisions for themselves. Nobody can come and tell them how to be friends with each other. And perhaps the same thing is true in Syria. On the other hand, you could argue that if America could come together with NATO and tell the Assad regime, we are going to support an invasion unless you find a way out, unless you lay down your arms, but also come up with an amnesty package that will allow the president, perhaps, and 100 of his closest men to leave somehow and reassure the Alawites and the minorities that they're not going to be persecuted, that their towns won't be overrun, that they're not going to be killed or hunted down if they were in the military. Those are the things that keep them fighting today. And, that doesn't mean, that's the only way you can see today, the Assad government laying down their arms and avoiding, I think, what looks like it could be a long and bitter struggle for power in Syria that divides the country down ethnic lines. So those are the two arguments. And, it's very hard to say which is the best argument. But I think a lot of Americans think like you do, which is we've had it. We've got to build our own schools. We've got to take care of our own people. We're beginning to suffer over here.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Joshua Landis. He is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. We're talking about recent developments in Syria. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Donated blood saves the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is on the web at bloodservices.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you each week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest is Robert Morgan. He's professor of English at Cornell University. We'll talk about a new book that he has written. It's titled Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. So we'll talk, that means west of the United States, talk about some of the leading figures in that part of American history. Then in the second hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about the future of the Postal Service. As you no doubt have heard in the news, the Postal Service is facing very significant financial challenges and would like to make some changes. That's very difficult because Congress doesn't seem to want to go along. Our guest for the show is Nancy Pindus. She is a senior fellow in the Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And we'll talk about some of the research that she has done on the value of the postal services and try to talk a little bit about how the problems of the postal service can be addressed. And you can get the schedule for the days and weeks ahead and also listen to past programs by going to our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies and associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment. That's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics that attracts several thousand readers every day. Certainly people in Washington read it, in Europe and in the Middle East. He regularly travels to Washington to consult with both the State Department and with the State Department, other government agencies. And he's been good enough to spend some time talking with us this morning about recent events in Syria. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, over the summer, there were reports of some defections from the Syrian military and attacks by former military against the government. Now, I don't know. It's probably not the not in numbers that would make a big difference, but numbers that are really too big to ignore. And I think at that point, people were saying maybe the country might be close to civil war. And given the fact that you said earlier that as long as President Assad continues to have generally have the support of the military, that he can at least hang on for some time, is there in fact any sense, any indication that there might be some significant divisions within the military over the question of Mr. Assad and the future of his government?
Well, that's been the hope of the opposition, that there would be a coup at the top ranks of the Syrian military, that Alawite officers near the president would throw him out and say he's incompetent and try to negotiate their way out of this. And that's always, you know, a slight possibility. I've tended to discount it because I think all these top officers know that divided they fall, and that if they, you know, the Syrian opposition has said that there's not going to be amnesty, and have said that they should all be tried. And so let's say they do make a coup like this. They will then open themselves and hand themselves over. The first thing the revolution is going to want to do is to strip them all of their rank and throw them out of it. They have been killing people. They have been responsible for the dictatorship for 40 years. They're not going to want to have them continue in power. This is like Iraq. When America landed, they decided to cashier the entire army and all the Ba'athists above a certain rank. And, you know, they swept the boards clean, and then people began to hunt these down, especially if you knew who had tortured you or who had abused you or killed a son. They hunted them down and shot them. So that's the fear in Syria. And it seems to me that's a very powerful glue to keep the top ranks of the military together. So, yes, there is... What's happening today is that low-ranked soldiers, particularly Sunnis, and Sunnis from the districts where the most turmoil is, Idlib in the north, Homs in the center, Dara in the south, where we've seen massive repression and uprising and military maneuvers, lots of deaths. Those soldiers are defecting. Now, it's still very hard to defect in Syria because the opposition owns no territory. So they have to go underground, sneak around. They're just today,
Assad announced that that people caught holding arms, being part of opposition groups with military arms, are going to be executed. So they face a life and death situation. Now, what they can do is run off to Turkey or to Lebanon, and that's what they've been doing in big numbers. That's where this Free Syrian Army is based. And Colonel Assad is there trying to put them together under one force. We don't know. There have been a number of journalist reports recently. People have gone in to Syria across the border, and they say that there's really no military unity or hierarchy. This Free Syrian Army was not invited to partake in the opposition talks in Tunis, where all the major opposition parties vetted Tunis the last few days. They were explicitly excluded, and people said nasty things about them. They do not want armed military uprising at this point, the political leadership in the outside. Why not? Because they're trying to work with America to get this condemnation in the UN. And to do that, they need to argue that this is a bad dictator killing peaceful demonstrators. They do not want to complicate this message by saying we are also supporting this military operation that is attacking Syrian soldiers and killing people. So, because the Russians, who are vetoing, are saying this is a civil war, we got to stay out of it. There's no place for us in this, and we have to get the two sides to negotiate with each other, not to take military, you know, forceful action to make one side give up and the other side win. So that's a very awkward situation. And as long as it goes on, it's not clear that there is a diplomatic way out of this. And it also gives President Assad the ability to say, look, as long as there's not a military intervention, I can take care of this situation. Yes, this is a major uprising. It's a major challenge. It's a mihna, as he calls it, a trial for the nation. But we will overcome. We've overcome in the past, 1982, when the Muslim Brotherhood rose up. We smashed them. And we're protecting Syria. We don't want to be like Iraq or Lebanon. George Bush tried to take us down. The Israelis want to take us down. Our neighbors, the Saudis, are trying to, and the Turks are both working with the opposition. We do not want to let this happen. And that's his line. Now, there have been over 1,200, depending on the figures you take, but military, Syrian army figures, soldiers, have been shot by the opposition since the beginning of this uprising. And that's part of this 5,000 dead figure. So it's about one to four, the death rate has been. So it's not been a completely unassailed government operation, but it largely has been. And the people have been sitting under this very difficult, oppressive regime for 40 years.
As you explained, the president, the military, the security apparatus, they're all Alawite, which is a branch of Shia Islam, and they're a minority in the country. Most Syrians are Sunnis. And this is one of the things that has made regime change difficult, because you can't split the security forces off from the president, as happened in Egypt and Tunisia, at least so far that hasn't happened. So we do have a kind of a sectarian dynamic here, at least between the leadership and most Syrians.
Yes,
are there some other ways in which that you see that as something that's influencing or shaping or driving the conflict?
It's driving it today. I mean, the major uprising areas have been poor Sunni areas. Yeah. Or areas like Homs. In the city of Homs is almost 50-50. It's a little bit more Sunni than Alawite, we believe. But the Alawites are newcomers to the city itself. And they've come from the agricultural regions around it, down from the mountains. And there is this ethnic diversity, which is not set easily. And what we're seeing today in the regions around Homs, and the countryside around Homs and Hama, these two central cities, is a lot of kidnappings taking place. Sunnis kidnapping Alawites, demanding ransom. Alawites then, kidnapping a bunch of Sunnis, demanding ransom. They kill each other and to threaten. Very bad things are happening. And this spiraling vengeance and kidnapping is spreading out. And the fear is that it would get out of control and become a civil war. It is not, today the opposition is adamant that this is not a civil war. They say it's a revolution being suppressed by a bad dictator.
part of this is just semantic, but it is, you know, it's very hard to see how this doesn't devolve to really nasty civil struggle if the Alawites remain loyal to the government and on the side of the military, and increasingly most Sunnis turn to the opposition. That hasn't really broken down today yet, but it's, you know, this is where things are moving. And so, you know, that it is, you know, the only way this can, it seems to me that you can get a peaceful resolution to this is if Assad believes he's going to lose, then he may begin to negotiate in good faith. And it's incumbent on also on both sides to try to allay the fears of the other. Sunnis need to tell the minorities in no uncertain terms what's going to happen to them, how they can save their lives, how they're going to be treated once this happens. You know, who is going to go to trial? Who is not going to go to trial? Will there be trials that are going to end with hangings, or are there going to be trials that end with some kind of, you know, like the South African, nonviolent, whatever? And the minorities also need to stand up. You know, Alawites have been silent. There have been no real, there have been some Alawites who've come out to the opposition, but people who are respected in the community, perhaps retired military officers, need to stand up and make a statement that this is, they are not, you know, that Alawites were, joined the revolution in the 1960s to make a better Syria, and that this Syria has gone astray, and that the Ba'athist regime has lost its way, and that the only way out of this is through negotiations and through real compromise and through some kind of democratic resolution. And that needs to be said on the part of Alawite leaders. How they can do that, I mean, that's taking their lives into their hands. They're going to be very – that sort of thing has never been rewarded in the past. It's been severely punished. So they're frightened of doing it. And the opposition hasn't really laid out a clear thing of how this is, could be reconciled. So that's where, you know, the bad signs seem to indicate that there, things could go from bad to worse, and that you get this very gloomy picture, and that you don't see the light or how this can come to a negotiated settlement.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at University of Oklahoma, where he is also associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies. We're talking about Syria, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. To talk just for a second about Egypt and what happened in Egypt, it seems that, at least from what I see in the conversations that I've had, what happened in Egypt is that there was this great wave of protest against the Mubarak regime. The military there, which was also extremely powerful, looked at it and thought their own interests were threatened, and they thought, and then they looked at Mr. Mubarak and thought, well, this guy's got to go if we're going to preserve our own position. And so they just stood back, let the demonstrators have their way. Mr. Mubarak left, but then power passed into the hands of the military, and although the military promised reform, now just recently we've seen a lot of Egyptians becoming very frustrated and saying, "Look, we didn't have this revolution so that we could have a military coup." So it remains to be seen what happens. But in that particular case, it seemed that the military thought it was in their interest to desert their man. Would there be any chance that the Syrian military might take the same path, or
I don't think so. Yeah. As you say, Tunisia and Egypt were very different because there, the protesters and the population could remain very disorganized and ununified, as long as but they all came out and had one objective in common: get rid of Mubarak and their president. And the military sided with the people and did the heavy lifting. They got rid of Mubarak. They got rid of the Tunisian president. But today, of course, what we're seeing in Egypt is that increasingly the military, which took over in this committee, is facing the people. Now, the military has moved towards the elections, and they've had these elections. The Muslim fundamentalists and the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis have done very well in that. They want to, I think, follow along with the military to get a constitutional convention and to try to rewrite the constitution. Now, the military has been making some rather arrogant statements that they're going to oversee this constitution writing. They're not going to let it be too Islamic. So there's pushback from both sides. But the Islamic forces are playing the game of the military, and they see this not as a bad thing to have the military, in a sense, providing security while they increasingly are allowed to take over government. They're going to come to a moment when the Constitution has to be rewritten and so forth, where push is going to come to shove, and we're going to see how much the military is going to relinquish the real reins of power. The seculars have been very disappointed in this whole thing, because they've discovered that at the polling booth, they were disorganized, they didn't have parties on the ground, and they've been swept out of real power. And those are the people who've been, in a sense, protesting against the military today. They don't want this Constitution to be sort of made up between the Islamists and the military. So, and it's dividing Egyptians. But it underlines the point you've made, which is the military turned against the dictator in these other Arab states. That is not the case in Syria, which means the people of Syria have to be super organized, because they're taking on not just the president with the army on their side, they're taking on the army. And that's going to require, a massive undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the army, Assad, in many ways, Hafez al-Assad, the father of this president, had been preparing for this day all of his life, unlike Mubarak. Mubarak let his kids go into Bank of America, and he didn't look after the military. The military in Syria, all of Assad's children went in and studied the arts of war. All of his cousins, the in-laws, so forth, are scattered throughout the intelligence and military service. Alawites, who are very close and loyal to the family, have been put into the key places. Ever since the 82 uprising of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, the Syrian regime has been expecting this day to come, and they've been planning for it, and they've been making sure that their military and security forces will stay loyal. That's the big difference from Egypt, in Tunisia.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of minutes left. We have a caller here in Champaign. We'll talk with them, and they're on line number one. Hello.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to frame this as a question, but perhaps you can remark on it. I think the people in the United States have a tendency not to recall the reasons why the Middle East is the way it is. Historically, if you think of how we engineered, were a big force for the disruption of the Ottoman Empire in the first, that used to rule Syria, and then, or the Middle East, and then, since the 1950s, we had the Cold War, where we helped also dichotomize the whole situation. And I wonder if you want to just refer to that latter period where we really, what was the dynamic where we, since we opposed Syria because it was a client of Russia, we opposed it for a while, Egypt because it was a client of Russia, et cetera, et cetera. Where do we really have any, we don't really have any moral credibility there, do we, or do we? I'll just leave it at that and let you talk. Thank you.
Well, you raise an important question, which is that the West, of course, has been a big actor and influencer in the Middle East for over 100 years. And that begins in a big way, of course, with the First World War, as you alluded to, because Britain and France attacked the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire joined the Germans, the Central Powers, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so the British and French attacked them. They divided up the Ottoman Empire, which ruled Syria and had ruled it for close to 400 years, and they divided up the Middle East. They played a big role there in the interwar years. Most of the Arab countries were mandates or occupied in one way or the other by the West. They get liberty at the end of the Second World War, but almost immediately there are coups against these very weak parliaments that were left behind. The United States supported the first coup in Syria by the chief of staff against the elected president, Shukri al-Khawatli of Syria. They thought that the chief of staff would make peace with Israel and allow the oil pipelines that America wanted to build through Syria to go through. And so they supported military dictatorship. So we are complicit in some level in the lack of democracy in Syria. Now, I say at some level because the Syrian situation was very unstable and was not going, was going to lead. This coup was going to take place, I think, whether America had really stepped in or encouraged it or not. And then we
got involved in other coup attempts. At the Suez time, the Suez crisis in 56, we were going to try to overthrow. The British tried to overthrow the government in Syria. In 57, American coup, what's called the American coup attempt, we got the right-wing people in Syria to try to push out the Russians and come in with a favorable government. That was discovered by the socialist wing, and it led, and they, most of the pro-Americans were condemned to death in absentia. Many of them fled. And this led to very unstable Syria for a long time. And we have been, had terrible relations with Syria for a long time, and largely because of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Syria has been part of this resistance front against Israel. And that has ensured that America has been at daggers drawn with Syria in one way or the other. Sometimes we've had fairly understanding relationship under Hafez al-Assad, who was very good never to let the Americans get completely alienated. But Bashar al-Assad has been less so. And that's partly due to George Bush's very aggressive policy in Iraq and in neighbors and threatening Syria. So, yes, we've had a difficult relationship. Do we have credibility? Well, in many ways, we've regained some credibility with this Arab Spring. And Syrians today, the Sunni Syrians in the opposition, and others are looking to America to save them, to intervene, to bring down this Assad government. And increasingly, they're asking for American help. And this is a big difference from 9 months ago, when Syrians pretty, you know, right across the political spectrum were following the government line, which is that America was an enemy of Syria.
We're going to have to stop at this point because we're here at the end of the time. We'll, of course, continue to watch what's going on. I understand, by the way, Professor Landis, that you're going to be here on the campus of the university in the spring.
I am indeed. I look forward to giving a talk on the Middle East. And some of your professors have been very kind in inviting me here, and I look forward to it.
Well, we hope maybe when you're here, we can get a chance to talk again.
I hope so.
Well, we appreciate your time this
Thank
morning.
You, David.
Thank you. Joshua Landis is our guest. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies, associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma.